to TFT Radio Episode 1. You might be wondering what the heck's going on. Well, let me see if I can explain. Back when I began TFT Radio's SOS chat radio, I did it to be listened to and participated in right after the SOS chat that was happening on Twitter on Tuesday nights, at this time, actually, from 6 to 7 Pacific. I'm in California. But lately, it hasn't been happening. SOS chat seems to have died. And there are some conflicting reports out there about SOS sort of generally, and I really have no idea what's up, but this is what I've heard, and I know this to be true from talking to SOS people, and that is that SOS has not officially taken a stand against the Common Core. And I know many of you have heard me say that and tweet that. But it's true. SOS has not yet condemned officially the Common Core. And once I had heard that, I decided that SOS was dead to me. Because the Common Core is sort of the looming disaster that's going to kind of finish off public schools. You know, they've already placed into law in many, many states and many, many, many districts teacher evaluations based on the scores of students, at least in part, which, you know, as listeners know, is not a good thing for kids or teachers. I won't go into all the reasons why, because you've heard me say them a million times. If you're not sure, then you need to find out why. You know, so we've got evaluations for teachers based on the scores of kids, which is a disaster. We've got the narrowing of the curriculum, which began back when NCLB started, and everybody realized that test scores were the only thing that mattered for your school or district. And so everybody started teaching to the test. And, you know, so for a decade or more, we've been schooling our little ones via the NCLB model, which is teaching to the test, which is a very narrow way to offer up a curriculum. Now, with the Common Core, what we've got are a set of standards, some of which are in direct opposition to children, to how people think, to how human beings are motivated. You know, the literature stuff in the Common Core is a disaster. It's even more narrowing than NCLB. There's no reading for joy. There's no reading literature for the sake of enjoyment. It's all about recall. Do you know what you read? Not how do you feel about it. Not how did it make you feel. Not any of that. Just do you remember the facts? So anyway, this is just a disaster. And SOS being the sort of original grassroots movement, mainly by teachers, but really by everybody interested in a well-rounded school experience for kids, you know, SOS was all about that and was all kind of doing the right thing and sounded good. Then the Common Core became king, and many of us who are involved in SOS started to wonder what the position was going to be. People left official steering committee type people left SOS as a result of this. And then when it became painfully clear that SOS was not going to condemn it in their last DC march, I decided that's that. I'm done. And I suppose this is where some of my comments on purity come into play. I've talked a little bit about purity. I've talked a little bit about the big tent that we all claim we want to have. But if that big tent includes support of Common Core, well, I don't want any part of that tent. And I want a group that is not afraid of putting their foot down and being firm about their position on the Common Core. Now, there is another group that I have gone ahead and affiliated myself with, and that is United Opt Out. The United Opt Out movement is all about opting out of the big test, the state test. In many states, it is absolutely legal for a parent to simply tell the administration of their kid's school that their kid ain't taking that test. They are opting out. In California, I know that's the law. I can opt my kid out anytime I want. A little point of pride here. My son is just began 10th grade, so last year was his first year of high school. And he opted himself out. The teacher kind of noticed that he wasn't taking the test, and I think what happened was he refused to accept the booklet or something, and the teacher called him up and asked him why, and my son said he's opting out, and he has that right, and he did. Awesome. Made me a very proud daddy. So I know in California you can opt your kids out. I know in lots of other states you can opt your kids out. Why? Why would you want to opt your kid out of the state test? Well, the reason you want to opt your kid out of the state test is because the data from the state test, all those data points, all those kids and their scores, are not used to help those kids. Those scores, those data points, are used to determine the average yearly progress, otherwise known as AYP, of the school. The actual school, not the district, the school. All schools have a rate of progress they're supposed to be meeting, and if they don't meet that average yearly progress, they get dinged. Inner city schools suffer the most in terms of scores because of their generationally impoverished students, and so they often don't make AYP. These are the schools that are slated for turnaround or shutdown or new curricular adoptions or, you know, all the nonsense that happens to a school that doesn't meet their average yearly progress. Again, the data used to determine average yearly progress, I mean adequate yearly progress, is the test, the big test. If we deny these people the data they covet, well, they cannot plug in their formulas and figure out the AYP. If they can't figure out the AYP, they can't ding anybody. So, there's a national movement, it's probably international, but it's certainly national, a national movement of people united in opting out from that giant, high-stakes, disgusting, tell-us-nothing test. So I've affiliated myself with United Opt Out. There are other highfalutin folks who are on board. The Chalk Face, when I talk to them or see him or them or whatever, I never know if it's both of them being Tim Slecker and Sean Johnson, or if it's just Tim or if it's just Sean, but I think they go together as the Chalk Face. Of course, they are their own individual human beings, but when they're doing Chalk Face stuff, I think they're both the Chalk Face. Anyway, they're basically the guys that kind of let me know about United Opt Out, and I took it on. That's the group I'm going to support now, because I want everyone to opt out of that test. We need to deny the district and the state that data. Realize all of the reform nonsense that you hear about, be it high-stakes testing or turnarounds or curricular adoptions or charters or vouchers, any of it, all of it, it all is the premise by which all this stuff is created and then foisted on us. The premise is the achievement gap. The achievement gap that we've known about for decades and decades, for like 60, 70 years, originally sort of discussed in the Coleman Report, not the new Coleman guy, the Common Core God, but the old, I don't know his first name, but it's called the Coleman Report, put out in the 60s, talking about integration and all those kinds of things. That was kind of the first time that the achievement gap was made popular and everybody knew what it was. And back then, when we looked at the NAEP, that's where we saw the achievement gap. We see that our affluent kids, or I should say the affluent schools, which are primarily the non-minority kids in those affluent schools, the difference in test scores between the affluent schools and the poor schools, that's the gap. And it's pretty much a correlation. If you do well, it's because you are richer and your parents are educated. More particularly, more specifically actually, your mother was educated. An educated mothers tend to be the ones with the children from 0 to 5 when the kids go to kindergarten. So an educated mother is a benefit for any child. An uneducated mother is not as much of a benefit for any given child. So those measures, a wealth measure, a poverty measure, a basic, you know, monetary measure, plus this education level of the parents, those two measures, there are others, but those two constitute socioeconomic status. When we talk about poverty, at least in sociological circles, and education falls into that, we're really talking about socioeconomic status, which includes both the money, how much that family's got, how much they make, plus education of the parents. Socioeconomic status is what we're talking about. The Coleman Report made it very, very clear back in the 60s that differences in socioeconomic status account for the gap, account for the achievement gap. In other words, give me your zip code and I will predict your school's test scores. Anyone can do it. That's how the real estate market works. When the real estate agent tells you that this neighborhood has a good school, what they're telling you is that neighborhood with the good school is an upper SES neighborhood. Okay, the school didn't create the neighborhood. The neighborhood populates the school. A school doing well is bound to have affluent kids in it. A school not doing well is bound to have a bunch of poor kids in it whose parents never went to college. It's been true since the 60s. It's true now. A very prominent researcher, Richard Rothstein, has put this out, and he's got graphics to go with it. I don't have the link right now, but he's the guy that has been telling you for a few years now that when you look at the NAEP, which is the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the one that Diane Ravitch used to actually be on the board of, she knows it intimately, she knows this stuff too, Scores for our low-income or low-SES kids and affluent kids, both sets of kids have had scores that have been rising for the past 30 years. In other words, kids of color score today where the highest scoring white kids scored in the 70s. All scores are rising. Let me say that again. All scores are rising. All, be they low SES scores, high SES, they're all rising. In fact, our minority population, primarily African American, those kids now score the bottom, now scores where the top affluent kids used to score. Okay? So all scores are rising, but the gap still persists. There is still a huge gap. Why? Very simple. Poverty. Generational poverty. And when I say poverty, I mean socioeconomic status. If your parents aren't educated, it's likely that you won't be. That's why you always hear about, when a child of a family is the first child in that family for generations or ever maybe to go to college. It's a big deal in a family who's got no college graduates. That's why everybody makes a big deal about it. Oh, the first kid in your family to go to college, that's fantastic. Those families suffer. Those families, those kids from those families do not do as well as kids from affluent families. And when I say affluent, I'm not talking rich. You know, gainfully employed. Teachers. Kids of teachers. Teachers do not make a lot of money, between $40,000 and $70,000. That's solid, sort of middle class, I guess. Those are affluent kids in this construction, okay? If you've got a roof over your head, food security, health care, and educated parents, you're going to do just fine. You'll do just fine. In fact, you'll be among the kids that score highest on earth. Because when we look at the PISA, which is the international comparison of student scores from country to country to country, if we remove our impoverished kids from our aggregated scores, we find that our affluent kids score higher than anybody else on earth, higher than Singapore, higher than Finland, higher than anyone. We are number one in the world. When you hear people say we're 17th in math and 25th in whatever, that's our aggregated scores. That's with our impoverished, lead-poisoned, hungry kids' scores being included. Many countries don't include all their scores. They include their good scores. We include everybody. We include our autistic kids. We include our SPED kids. Everybody gets included. When you disaggregate those scores and you simply look at our affluent kids, we outscore the whole world. So this nonsense that our schools are a failure is pure nonsense. If our schools were failures, we probably wouldn't have the highest scoring kids on earth. But we do. We also have some very low scoring kids. Why? Well, we do have a 25% child poverty rate, which is the highest this country's ever seen. We've had massive unemployment now for a few years. We've never addressed poverty in the way that would make a difference to someone living in it. So here are a couple suggestions. And Martin Luther King suggested it. A couple of concepts. Let me start with one that's somewhat related, but not exactly. Think about this. For any endeavor, for any service you plan to offer to human beings, if you can take care of the extremes in your demographic, in other words, using school, if we want to create a school that serves all the kids, we need to look at the extremes of who those kids are. One extreme is the super bright, the highly gifted super bright kids. The other extreme is the special education kids, kids with deficits or developmental disabilities or whatever. If you construct a school system that focuses or that deals with those two extremes, the super bright and the super challenged, well, then you're probably going to be taking care of the middle two. Just, you know, the middle is the easy part. If you've dealt with the extremes, the middle just kind of happens automatically, right? That's what we're doing now. We're just not funding it, right? We claim we have gate programs for the gifted and talented. We don't. We're not taking care of them. We claim we have special education and IEPs and all that. We don't fund that. We don't do anything about that. But our kids in the middle, you know, pretty much do fine. So let's take care of the two extremes. Let's see to it that our super bright kids are excited about school, challenged by school, and let's see to it that the least among us are developmentally disabled. Let's see to it that they get what they need. And Martin Luther King said that if we take care of poverty, in other words, if we see to it that folks are not worried about housing and food and health care, education will just follow. In other words, once you are healthy and secure, you can reap the benefits of school. But if you're afraid and sick and not healthy, school is a burden. So, what can we do to help the least among us? Because that's who we need to focus on right now. There's too many of them, and the number's growing. How do we deal with those families? How do we create a situation for those families where their kids will be able to go to public schools anywhere and reap the benefits of a public school education? They need health care. That's one of the first things they need. Lots of kids come to school with illness, lead poisoning from the squalor in which they live, dental issues. They need health care. A clinic just doesn't cut it. They need to be able to go to the doctor. The only way we're ever going to make that happen is with universal health care. So we need universal health care. You know, it's not like universal health care is impossible. We are the only industrialized nation on earth that doesn't have it. Why? Pure greed. No other reason. Pure greed. The oligarchs are greedy, and they run the show. So the first thing we can do to help kids is give them health care. The second thing, of course, is books. We need to stop closing libraries, both public libraries, you know, city libraries, county libraries, whatever, and school libraries. And we need to fill those libraries with, you know, librarians, human beings that understand and know about books. I don't mean, you know how they're constructed. I mean, you know, a kid walks into a library and says, I'm into this or that, and the librarian needs to be able to go, okay, well, here's four suggestions. You know, we don't have that now. I remember the last couple of years I was in a classroom, our librarian got the boot due to money, so she retired. She was one of those old ones who had been a librarian forever. She was incredible. She left, retired. And we got another woman in who was awesome, but she was a library tech. and, you know, she knew the Dewey Decimal System really well, and she was very sweet, very bright, but she was not a librarian. She didn't have all the knowledge of the thousands and thousands of books that kids might be into. She just didn't know that stuff. So that made the library kind of, you know, worthless, at least for the kids who needed some help navigating that library. The bright kids never needed the librarian, so they do what they do. The kids who are struggling need a librarian. Stephen Krashen talks about books all the time and mentions the fact that so many kids, especially underprivileged kids, don't have books at home. Nobody gives them books. The offerings in Scholastic or the free books that a teacher gives away are just not the best books. So they need to be able to get their hands on books. Libraries is the way to do it. Teachers, if you're out there listening, you know, how many of you, and I know this is true, I did it, and I know every teacher I know has done it, how often do you give books to these kids right from your own library? All the time. Which is why us teachers are always asking for money for books, or just bring us your gently used books. It's always the relatively affluent families who do all the donating of books because they're the ones who can afford them. And then we give those books away to kids who can't afford them, and we just give them to them. I gave away so many books over the years, and nothing feels better than doing that, especially when it's a book that you know. Well, here, let me just start over and say, don't give a book to a kid. Notice a kid reading a book, and then walk up to that kid quietly and say, "You want that book, man? It's yours. Bring it over to my desk. We'll write your name in it." It has to come from them. They don't want you to choose the book. Let them choose the book. And then surprise them and give it to them. Some of them won't want to take it home. Lots of reasons why they won't want to take it home. Tell them they can keep it in your desk. So, universal health care and books. Those two things would help our low socioeconomic status families pretty much more than anything else besides decent jobs, which is really the third thing we need. We need jobs. We don't need Burger King jobs. We need some real jobs, some manufacturing jobs. Too bad we ship those all overseas. We need to bring them back. Or we need to start new industries, which is why the green movement seems somewhat promising. But of course that's not getting funded because we still have to drill or whatever. So, I'm done with SOS. I'm now enamored of United Opt Out, and I know how to fix our education woes, because they're not education woes, they're societal woes that seep into everything. The classroom is a mirror of society, people. A lot of folks will say that the classroom is the creator of society. Walk into classrooms in the heart of Richmond, California, and then walk into a classroom in Piedmont, California. They're 10 miles away from each other, and you will see that those classrooms reflect the neighborhood. Those classrooms don't create the neighborhood. Ask all these famous, incredibly wealthy athletes, professional athletes, who grew up in abject poverty and escaped. Do they go back? Do they go back and do up their old hood? No, they don't. No, they move to Fancy Town and wash their hands of where they came from. Most of them. Some of them do. Some of them do go back and help. But you'd think from what people say, you know, that anyone can lift themselves out of poverty and education creates society. Well, Not unless society takes on that responsibility, and they don't. Because when you're poor and you escape that shit, you don't want to go back. And if you made a lot of money, you don't want to go throw all that money into some old hood that you know is going to help temporarily. Why? Because in the hood, people will still suffer from food insecurity, evictions, so in other words, homelessness, medical issues. You know, one very wealthy athlete cannot fix an entire neighborhood. So our social policy is directly tied to education policy. And unless we create a situation where families feel more secure, we're going to have a bunch of insecure, when I say insecure, I mean insecure in terms of food and housing and all those things. Insecure people do not really care much about the test. They care more about food and where they're going to live and if they're going to be sick. So society creates itself. Society is reflected in classrooms. Let me put it this way. Let's assume that everyone in America has a roof over their head that cannot be taken away and enough food to last them for the rest of their lives. Do you think you would be seeing the same educational issues in school if everybody had that security? Teachers in the inner city especially, know the answer. The lay person on the outside may have an idea, but they don't have any evidence or experience to back up what they think might be the truth. Teachers do. Healthy, well-fed kids have a much easier time in school, especially if they grew up in a house with educated parents, so that they were able to start school with a reasonably sized vocabulary. Generationally impoverished kids have tiny vocabularies compared to affluent kids. They start school at a deficit. You cannot make up that deficit easily. I suppose it can be made up, but it's certainly not easy. Wouldn't it be easier to simply have a more progressive tax structure and fund universal health care and housing and libraries? Then all these families that you're so worried about will suddenly be able to lift themselves up. Why? Because they have the basics. Their basic needs will be met. They will no longer have to worry about where their next meal is going to come from. They won't have to worry about being sick because they'll be able to be taken care of. Low SES kids won't have to come to school with toothaches that never get dealt with. It ain't rocket science. The reformers would like you to think it's complicated. I heard Jonathan Alter, that raging bald-headed idiot, on Melissa Harris Perry on Education Nation, talking about KIPP schools are the good ones, and he got called out because it's nonsense. And he went and got all upset, and Melissa Harris Perry had to put her hand in his face and shut him up. You know, the media out there are wrong. They get it wrong. They don't know the facts. They're pushing an agenda. Don't listen to Jonathan Alter. He's an idiot. Just a numbskull. Complete numbskull. I think I was about to relate something to that John. I don't know. Anyway, so I wanted to kind of make it clear what the deal was with SOS, why I have no part in it anymore. I encourage everyone to go look up United Opt Out, find out what that is all about. I encourage you to opt your kids out. And that's kind of all for that topic. The next topic, I don't really have one, but I do want to say that my nonprofit, Stronger Than Dirt, is almost has its exempt status. But the school that is owned by Stronger Than Dirt, which is currently under a fiscal sponsorship, so it does have nonprofit status, it's been a long time, but I got the license. It's a done deal. The school on the hill is wide open and accepting children. Huh? How do you like that? I'm pretty proud that I made it happen. Now I just need a couple of kids. I figure I need about 3 full-price kids, and then I can subsidize 3 more at half price or maybe even better. So I'm very, very proud that has happened. It was a big, huge production. There's still stuff going on dealing with the IRS and getting my corporation its tax-exempt status. But I got to tell you something about this whole thing. I think I talked about it a little bit before. But it's a mixed bag. Let me just say that it was the most exciting thing I probably ever did besides running a summer camp, which you might not know it, but that's pretty exciting. In a totally different way. But putting this whole nonprofit thing together in this school was quite the education. I mentioned before in another show how I went about kind of starting this thing, and I was talking to a rich guy and asked him, you know, we didn't necessarily agree on education reform, and I said, you know, why don't you put your money where your mouth is, because he was making statements about, well, he tried to sound agreeable. So I challenged him to put his money where his mouth was, and to his credit, he said, all right. But I had to get nonprofit status. So that was the whole deal with getting the fiscal sponsor, which we got, and the rich guy and his foundation gave me a little bit of money. Not a lot. Less than I had hoped. But they did. So thanks. And now, as I'm spending that money getting things together, I have to constantly, you know, try to raise funds. And that means grant writing and asking foundations for money. And yesterday, I think I've mentioned I'm working with a couple of people. Obviously, I have a board of directors, but I also have just a couple of consultant-type people who are friends helping me with this. And we are dealing with grant writing. And we're not grant writers. And these foundations that dole out the grants have all these specific needs. They need all kinds of information. They want a narrative about your blah, 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 you know, before they're going to give you the money. So we've got foundations out there with, you know, billions of dollars to give. But they only give it if you fill out their application exactly right and you jibe with their thang, whatever their thang is. Well, here's what I've come to realize. I've come to realize that foundations and philanthropy is a scam. It's a total scam, and I'll tell you why. If a foundation wanted to help citizens, you know, to become a 501c3 a 501c3 is an IRS designation. You are a charity. You are a public charity. In other words, you don't have to pay taxes because you're doing good for the public. That's what my corporation, my nonprofit corporation, Stronger Than Dirt, exists to help kids get money to come to the school on the hill. So my corporation directly benefits low-income families. My corporation pays no salaries, nothing like that. In other words, me, the president of the corporation, I don't get paid to be president. My directors don't get paid to be directors. Nobody gets a paycheck for being part of Stronger Than Dirt. Stronger Than Dirt does own the school, so Stronger Than Dirt will be paying the director's salary and rent and juice boxes and stuff like that, but that is for the children. So my corporation enriches nobody. It exists to get money and then give that money to needy families or use that money to help subsidize needy families. Well, the only way I could get money was to become a 501c3. In other words, foundations, charitable givers, only give to charities. In other words, tax-exempt gives to other tax-exempt. Nobody just gives. They only give when they can write it off. And in this way, the folks that run these foundations, they never give away their money. They're never actually giving it away. There's billions of dollars that seem to be floated around all these 501c3s. They give it to each other, and then they write it off. Seems to me it would make more sense to simply tax these rich people more, take that revenue, and make life cheaper for the little guy. Right now, the way it is, if you're a little guy and your credit's not great, loans cost you more, right? A rich guy with good credit gets a better rate than a poor guy with not so good credit. Well, how does that help the poor guy? It doesn't, because the system's not designed to help the poor guy. The system is designed to help the big cheese and to keep the big cheese in the big cheese. So as I look at these foundations and try to get grants written, I get sick to my stomach. Because what I'm trying to do is help some of the neediest kids, little kids, trying to give them the background knowledge they need that they don't get because they live in a family that is low socioeconomic status. I'm trying to help these kids so that when they do begin public school, they'll begin at the same place my kid began. He knew all his letters. He knew all his numbers. He could almost read when he started kindergarten. And that's not special. I'm not bragging. Everyone in my situation has kids like that because they have educated parents. We read to our kids. We had the time. We had the knowledge. So I'm starting to hate myself in a way for being the president of a corporation, albeit nonprofit, but I it's not how I would have chosen to do it if there was some other way. You know, if some rich guy said, "Here, I'll give you $20,000, go start a school," I would have done it. Part of what I think these rich guys like to see is they like to see you jump through hoops. They like to watch pathetic little lay groups who want to do good in their community. That's me. They like to see how well we can jump through their little hoops because they only want to give money to good hoop jumpers. Philanthropists shouldn't control the flow of money. they shouldn't have so much of it in the first place, and they shouldn't be so stingy with it. They should give it more freely and without such restriction. And the only reason they do it is to keep themselves flush. Seriously, go find one of these foundation folks and see how they're living. Trust me, they're living very, very large. I'm not. Most of us aren't. And they shouldn't. So, to summarize, SOS, Save Our Schools group, has not yet denounced the Common Core state standards. They're dead to me now because of that. I have since affiliated myself with the United Opt-Out movement, a much better movement that absolutely condemns the Common Core and would like you to opt your children out of the state test, and I couldn't agree more. The next thing, how do we solve our achievement gap? With social policy. There is no education policy without social policy, and we need to deal with our low socioeconomic status, generationally impoverished members of our country, and they need health care just like you. They need food security just like you, and they need housing security just like you. Until they have that, they will not be able to perform in school the way my kid performs in school, who has all that security, at least for now. And then lastly, trying to get money from foundations makes me sick, to be quite honest. I don't like it. America doesn't seem to exist to help each other. America seems to exist to make money off each other. And I'll tell you, I hate that. That's ugly. It's very, very ugly. You're not supposed to make money off your family. We're all Americans. At least I think we're supposed to be. The oligarchs are not. As far as I'm concerned, they are not American. They are part of a teeny tiny international cabal of mega wealthy assholes who run the world. So, America, time to take back your country in the sense that not the commies have taken over like the teabaggers would have you believe, but the mega wealthy, privileged, snooty oligarchs have stolen everything. Citizens United was kind of the icing on the cake. That's the America that exists now that we need to take back from the oligarchs and give it back to the people. There's been some talk somewhere about North and South and should the North secede. And I'll be very honest with you. It's a joke and all. But yeah, we should. We really should. The South just hasn't figured it out yet. They're still too mired in their horror. So, you know, until they get their shit together, I say, we leave them. They'd probably be happy to go. So, listeners, don't let people talk you out of what you know. Don't let common sense be beaten out of you. Poor, hungry, ill, in pain children don't do well in school. Those are the ones that the education reform movement claims to be helping. They're absolutely not. Not one kid has been helped by the reform movement. They've only been hurt. They've been tested. Their schools have been shut down. Their teachers have been fired. Their state union may have been fucked with by some governor. Collective bargaining rights within a state. The ed reform movement has no desire to help the least among us. The ed reform movement is basically a right-wing cabal, but that's not entirely accurate. We need to change the way we talk about the cabal now. Yes, it's right-wing, but the right-wing has apparently expanded to just be the rich wing. Democrats with money might as well be Tea Partiers now. I'm talking about you, Whitney Tilson, Eli Broad, Gideon Stein, all of you guys who are funding CMOs and giving Michelle Rhee money and paying for the Broad Academy and paying idiots like Jonathan Alter, you people, even if you claim to be Democrats, you are not. You are not Democrats. I don't care that you call yourselves Democrats. You are not, in fact, Democrats. What you are right-wing oligarchs who think you're better than everybody. You're not. You got lucky. Most of you grew up rich kids. Okay? Had you not grown up rich kids, you would just be regular Joes. Okay? You're not special. Well, you are sort of special because you think you're special, but don't realize you're not. You don't know more than the regular Joe out there. You think you do, and your highfalutin education gave you some big words and some fancy ways of talking. But you don't know more. In fact, you know less because you live in a bubble, a rich little bubble filled with champagne. You don't get out much. You tell people you get out, but you don't get out much. You wouldn't be caught dead hanging out in my house. I wouldn't let you. No. The rich have decided that they own everything, and they are making sure that none of it can get taken away. That's what the education reform movement is. It is a means to privatize public education because it's a multi-billion-dollar industry, and these oligarchs want their fingers in that billion-dollar pile. That's all it is. It assures them that they will win, whatever winning means. They will die rich. Yeah, that's probably true. As the poor eat you, you will be rich, but you will be eaten and dead. So don't let the Democrats for Education Reform fool you. Defer, they are not Democrats. Don't let an oligarch claim that he is a Democrat. He's not. He's an oligarch. Oligarchs do not have a party. Oligarchs give to both parties. Oligarchs are oligarchs. They run the parties. So don't be fooled. Do not be fooled. It is up to us, the little guy, to fix everything. While being beaten down by oligarchs. So, help me. You can help by going to www.tsoh, that's TSOF, the school on the hill, .org. Make a donation. Help me help some low SES kids in Richmond, California. Help me give them the background knowledge they need so that when they go and start kindergarten, they're ready, and no oligarch can keep them down. Please, it's up to us. It takes a village. We, just the regular Joe citizens, are the village. The rich guys, no. They want you to eat cake, but they won't give you any flour. All right, ma'am. Peace out.